and thank you for listening to Raleigh Little Theater's podcast series in support of our production of Perfect Arrangement. This is part two in a three-part series of podcasts that we are bringing to you to support our production. If you haven't listened to part one yet, I encourage you to pause this for a little bit and go back and listen to part one, where I interview playwright Topher Payne, and we talk a little bit more in depth about the actual content of the play. I think you'll find that insightful and useful as we continue into these next two podcasts. On today's episode, I interview James Miller, who's the executive director of the LGBT Center here in Raleigh. And one of the reasons that I really wanted to interview James for this series is to talk about the real life experience of people in the LGBTQ plus community, their experiences coming out, what kind of services are available for them, and to just give a perspective into the play that is from the real world. James has a ton of experience working with wonderful people and volunteers and clients, and can really just speak to the true experience that's represented in the play, especially in terms of discrimination and some of the obstacles that are in front of the LGBTQ plus community. So I'm really excited to bring you this portion of the podcast series, and I think you'll enjoy hearing from James. So here we go.
All right, so now I'm here with James Miller, who's the executive director of the LGBT Center here in Raleigh. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us a little bit about the center and your role here?
Sure. So the center was founded in 2009. Amazing group of individuals came together and recognized the need in the Triangle for something like this, for the greater community. Fast forward 9 years later, we're here on Harrington Street. We have 4,000 square foot right now in a downtown prime location with a library of over 5,000 and a DVD collection of 250. It's a drop-in space. We have 22 programs and services that we do through the center. It's an amazing space, and we like to call ourselves a community center first because we're not asking for, you know, identification on upon walk-in. Mm-hmm. It's really, we're trying to take care of everybody first.
That's great. So in this play, you know, it takes place in 1950, and mm-hmm. it deals with the Lavender Scare, which was mm-hmm. the State Department firing sexual deviants.
Yes.
Which translated directly to the LGBT mm-hmm. community at that time. And one of the reasons I picked the play and was really excited by it is I feel like, you know, when we were considering this and putting on the season, we were still in the middle of HB2, mm-hmm. and it felt so relevant. And I know that that law has been partially taken away, but it still feels like this play has something to say to us now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just wondering from your experience, if you can talk a little bit about the discrimination that LGBTQ mm-hmm. people face in Raleigh particularly, mm-hmm. and some of the stuff that you've seen mm-hmm. happening.
Well, what I really enjoyed about your choice in this play for Perfect Arrangement is that a lot of people don't understand that, yes, you know, this takes place in 1950, but the executive order that was issued was not rescinded until 1995. So this, the law, the Lavender Scare, the purging of LGBT people in governmental jobs, didn't stop until 1995. And I think that that's a hugely relevant point for us to remember, that our history in this is not very long. I think it's also extremely relevant with the ascension of the Trump administration and many individuals. You know, it, not only sexual orientation and gender identity, but also race, poverty, individuals who are experiencing homelessness. A lot of individuals have a reason to fear what is going on with our administration and what's going on with, you know, state and local politics as well. So I think if we're looking at the Lavender Scare as a proxy, I think it's perfect for this day and age to remind people that it wasn't so long ago that, yes, if you were out at work, you were in the bullseye of being fired. So it's important for us to, you know, kind of know our history and, you know, understand J. Edgar Hoover was never a real friend of the LGBT community. But the history there, I'm excited about it because it could really inform people that we're not, you know, they weren't around in 1950, like myself, that, you know, there was a history that we didn't really talk about. And people tend to think that the queer movement starts at Stonewall, but in fact, it started decades before. So,
yeah. And you know, I think another interesting thing that something I definitely wanted to ask you about is this idea of this arrangement and this hiding of who they are, and they can only be truly who they are inside their house, mm-hmm. with the windows shut, yep. and be away. And I guess I understand in 1950 why that was a necessity, but it, mm-hmm. feels like, from some folks that I've talked to, that hiding goes on in different ways, mm-hmm. still. And what do you think it is? You know, I think in a lot of ways we want to feel like we've come so far.
Yep.
But for LGBTQ people, what are some of the things that they're facing that make them want to hide that aspect of who they are?
You know, I think we have a lot of issues and preconceived notions of different populations. I think when we're saying all these victories, like marriage equality and all these different things, they're not really focusing on people at the core. It's people of privilege getting to the point where they think they should be. You know, individuals who identify as queer or questioning as young people are 4 to 5 times more likely to attempt suicide. Individuals that are experiencing, we have more individuals disproportionately impacted in the queer community than any other community in homelessness. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to understand a lot of these wins, these policy movements. They make the world better, yes. It's incrementalism at its core. But the things that we're looking at are not necessarily all just black and white. Oh, we want marriage equality. We win. I mean, you look back, the Civil Rights Act didn't abolish racism. Mm-hmm. Marriage equality is not going to get rid of homophobia. So I think if we look back and really kind of, like, I don't know how to measure it, but look at non-traditional couples, you know, Loving versus Virginia was only, 40 years ago, and that was interracial marriage for heterosexual couples. I'm sure that individuals, and I've experienced this with one of my boyfriends, that he was African-American and I was white, and people looked at us funny. And I think that race relations are still going to be an issue, no matter where we are. Trans issues have really come to the forefront in the last decade, and I think that population is something that we need to be vigilant for and advocate for, because I think, you know, the roots of inequality really are lying in the fear, and people don't know these individuals. In 1950, when this play was set, there wasn't an opportunity for people to get to know another, what they call a homosexual, which in the South it's homosexual, so it's fine. There wasn't a chance for that. There wasn't a chance to get to know one another, and so I think a lot of the media movement and a lot of the visibility we've been able to obtain has really changed hearts and minds. And I think that we need to be very consistently pressuring people to remind themselves that they can meet a trans person and not fear what they don't know. They can meet an asexual, pan, demisexual, anyone under the umbrella of the queer community. And if they just get to know them, I think we'll see a huge difference in what we can accomplish in the term of equality, or at least equity.
Mm-hmm. So another aspect of the play is, I think, you know, the question ultimately comes down to what are you willing to sacrifice in order to live into your truth? Mm-hmm. And in this play in particular, it is the livelihoods of mm-hmm. these folks who are hiding who they are. But I'm wondering what the modern day parallel mm-hmm. is for people who are choosing to come out. What is at stake mm-hmm. nowadays?
It's a really interesting question, because it differs for every different community that we really look at. Young people are feeling more empowered to come out earlier. They see themselves in TV shows and commercials and movies, and it's incredible. I think, you know, with our youth program here, I think one of our youngest is 9 years old, and they know who they are, and they are willing to live in it, and they are just going gangbusters about their life. I didn't come out until I was 18 in college, when I knew that I had housing and I was safe. So I think time really does tell, and a lot of our individuals in our SAGE program, which is services and advocacy for GLBT elders, many of them didn't come out till 60 or 70 years old, and they weren't able to build a family. They weren't able to, you know, have relationships because of the fear of, you know, what has happened. I do believe that the HIV crisis in the 80s really brought a lot of the groups and a lot of the conversation to a head, and it forced people to have conversations that they didn't want to have. Mm-hmm. So I think in coming out, I think every group will have, you know, their pros and cons. But I also understand that, you know, you have to be who you are, and to basically bottle it up is just going to force you into a really dark place. And I think it's even more interesting when you overlay, you know, employment and relationships and family and religion, because I think, and it's gotten 100 times better, I know this for employers, but, you know, there's still individuals who are afraid to come out at work, especially if they're, you know, police officers, firefighters, nurses, doctors, because they don't want that to be a defining character on their, you know, their experience, or they don't want that to be the defining factor on who they are. And I think if we're looking at individuals in employment, you know, there's a lot of, you know, casual heterosexism that happens every day in every office. You know, it's really tough for some people who don't necessarily want to come out, but they do have a partner. Do they put a picture in their cubicle? Do they have any cutesy things, like small gifts or, you know, little tchotchkes that are there? You know, it's a tough challenge for some people to determine where they feel safe at. And that, again, it's layer upon layer of having to come out constantly in your life. So it's... it never ends. It just gets a lot easier every time you have to do it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. And I think kind of coming out of that, I think this play is really, it's focused on the LGBT community and of the time, especially in 1950. Mm-hmm. But I think it has really something to say to every audience member who mm-hmm. comes about, what are we willing to stand for? What are we willing mm-hmm. to stand up for? Mm-hmm. Who are we willing to fight for? And at what cost,
yep.
right? There's these huge questions that I think are important for all of us to be asking ourselves. And I think my question for you is how do we, if we're not in the LGBTQ community, how can we be allies? Mm-hmm. How can we be helpful mm-hmm. in situations where we notice discrimination?
Yep. So first and foremost, you have to protect yourself first. And so whenever our program here, Raleigh Allies, is teaching individuals how to turn friends into allies. I always want to remind people to always feel safe in their own space first. So, you know, you might hear a sexist comment or a racist comment in the office, and by all means, I think it should be called out, homophobia and sexism. However, if you don't feel safe by doing that, if it's your boss or, you know, somebody, please talk about it, but don't think that, you know, missing one opportunity to be an ally doesn't mean you're not going to be a better ally in the future. So, you know, really take account of the individuals you surround yourself with the conversations that you personally have. I think I still really tend to, like, hey y'all, or group guys, hey you guys, like I use very, you know, pro-masculine terms, and I have to catch myself a lot lately to remind myself that this is not something that we should be, you know, not everything has to be male-dominated, and I hope we're moving towards that direction. A few other things is, one is really just educate yourself and meet the community. So in the center, we do have, like I said, a program called Raleigh Allies, and they do different presentations every quarter. So we've done everything from the history of drag queens to how to be a better ally to our youth program coming in and just having a panel and having adults ask them how they feel about certain situations. It's those opportunities to meet people in the communities that you're not, you know, in the circle with that can really change hearts and minds in that. So, you know, it's always about a story. I can't sit down in a group of people and say, you know, 1 out of 5 seniors, you know, don't have an emergency contact. You know, statistics are great. But if you can put a face and a name to that story, like Gerald fell in the tub and didn't have anyone to call and passed away on his floor. Yeah. I mean, those are the stories that, you know, that can be impactful to moving policy forward. And I think that if we use the statistics and give you stories, I mean, that's really important. It's also important to note that the oppressed should never hold the burden to educate the oppressor. So I think it really is on allies to seek out opportunities, to seek out situations. And there's a whole myriad of possibilities that individuals, especially in the triangle, can be a part of. And one of my favorite things about our center is that it doesn't matter that you come to an LGBT 101. It matters that you care about social justice and your fellow man. So if you're looking at doing an ACLU fundraiser or Planned Parenthood, or you're at Haven House wanting to give hours, interact, the Raleigh Wake Partnership to End and Prevent Homelessness, all these organizations have queer people in them. We use those services. We need those services. And so by helping any progressive organization that understands that, you know, queer people are people, you are being an ally to this community. So, you know, getting the stats and the understanding behind you is great. And getting the stories from the people is even better. But know that, you know, there's a shared humanity that we're trying to push forward that really just focuses on people being people. So I think, you know, allies and even queer people sometimes beat themselves up to think, what else could we do? And I would be a terrible executive director if I didn't say, hey, there's a charity here. If you want to toss some dollars our way, we'll do that. A lot of my fantastic ally and the ally partners, they don't necessarily give money. They come by, they volunteer at the front desk, they buy sodas for our youth program, they buy, you know, the 30-pack at Costco chips box, I don't know, stuff like that that brings in, so we don't have to use resources to be able to feed people or be able to, you know, really take people in. So it's, being an ally is an interesting question, and I really think that it comes down to the fact that you just have to care for other people. And I feel in my heart that 99.9% of the triangle is there to help their fellow person. So we're going to work on that 0.1%.
Awesome. Absolutely. And my last question for you is just what role do you see ARC playing in helping the LGBTQ community, particularly with plays like Perfect Arrangement? Do you think they're valuable?
For the queer community, the arts have always been valuable, I will say, in a very direct tone that, you know, the arts have always been a place for us to explore and be able to go outside of our own realm and be able to invite other people into our realm. Plays like this offer an opportunity for a group of individuals who would otherwise not be interested in the boring humor, like, tell you that Eisenhower passed Executive Order 10450 and blah, 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 and kicked all the queer people out. This play actually has a lot of humor laced into it. And I think that, and it's perfect for me because that's how I kind of get across to people. I use humor to disarm, and I really try and get under their skin with facts. So I think the arts have always been that exceptional place. And we did a Mothers and Sons play last season, and it was myself and Lee Storo and a mother of a young man who passed away. And it may have been super sad, but it had its high points. And I think, you know, driving that emotion, and it goes back to the idea of putting a name and a face to that. The storytelling is what changes policy. Statistics have never changed a politician's mind, ever, unless they were really terrible, which I'm sure there were. But anyways, I just think that you're looking at the ability to get the message across in a way that's not authoritarian. You're not telling them that this is wrong and this is what happened. You're showing them why it's wrong and why it happened. So I think it's, you know, Raleigh Little Theater and Intrac and all the other great theater companies in town, they don't shy away from queer topics, which I think is the more important part, especially in a southern state, in a very conservative, mildly conservative state now, hopefully. I do think that it's important for us to always be on that forefront and be a little more avant-garde with it. Suffice it to say that, you know, art has always held a strong piece of queer community. And honestly, oral queer history. I mean, it's really taken stories that would have been lost to the times. And so, I mean, there's many examples, and you're an arts guy, and I'm not necessarily that. could tell you the policy of Executive Order 10450, but can't really go into what, you know, Angels in America, the impact that that made, or, you know, Mothers and Sons, or anything Tennessee Williams. I mean, I think there's a lot there, and it's important for us to be supportive of that, because in some ways there's not really an easy way to explain to my kids what it was like in the 1950s.
And there you have it, folks, my interview with James Miller of the LGBT Center. I want to personally thank James for the time that he took to talk with us, and just for the great insight that he gives us into the play and how it remains relevant, and how there are still obstacles to overcome for the LGBTQ+ community. If you're interested in the LGBT Center, you can find them on the web at thelgbtcenterofraleigh.com. I'm Patrick Torres. I'm the Artistic Director here at Raleigh Little Theater, and I want to remind you that Perfect Arrangement by Topher Payne runs here in the Sutton Theater from October 27th through November 12th, and I encourage you to get your tickets now. On the next and final episode of our podcast, we will be hearing from Christopher Brook, who's the legal director of the ACLU of North Carolina. I'm really excited for that episode, and Chris really did help me better understand some of the legal aspects of the play and ways in which discrimination still plagues us today. So I look forward to you getting to hear from him. And so please tune in when we release that podcast. And thank you so much for your time. And we hope to see you at the theater.